money.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round.
A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound,
a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound
is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound
can make the world go round.
Money, 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 money.
If you happen to be rich and you feel like a nice entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring
ting-a-ling
for the mate. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht.
What? Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes us go around, of that we both are sure on being poor.
Money, 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 money.
Money, money, money.
Money, 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 money.
When you haven't any coal in your stove and you freeze in the winter and you curse to the wind that you fate. When you haven't any shoes on your feet, your coat's thin as paper and you look 30 pounds underweight. When you go to get a word of advice from the fat little pastor, he will tell you to love evermore. But when longer comes to rap, rat-a-tap, rat-a-tap at the window.
At the window.
Who's there?
Hunger.
Oh, hunger.
See how love flies out the door. Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world. Money makes the world go round, the clinking, clanking sound.
Money, 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 money. Get a little, money, 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 money. Mark a yen, a buck or a pound. That clinking, clanking, clunking sound is all that makes the world go round.
It makes the world go round.
Let's go back to some of the points from the phrases you were referring to about dealing with reality and what actually happened, seeing what might work. In a nutshell, looking back from today, 2014, early-ish, what did happen? What was this financial crisis?
So that, again, we could go on for many, many critical thinking programs on. There were a lot of changes in the financial markets and in the economy overall that had happened in the last couple of decades. Changes in the way that banks got their money, changes in the way housing was financed, and there were a lot of risks that were embedded in that that weren't fully understood either by the markets or by the regulators. And so when there were some questions that started to be raised about whether some types of mortgages, these so-called subprime mortgages, would be able to pay off, whether they whether the people who had taken them out would be able to afford to repay, and whether they would repay, that started a broader chain reaction about people raising questions about the value of other types of securities, of other types of activities, and then starting to think about the exposures that that people had. In the old days, everything was very local. So in Chicago, we had so-called unit banking. That is, you had one bank and that was it. No branches, no nothing else. And so, and typically banks would lend locally. So it was like someone had read a finance textbook and said, how can we make the system as risky as possible? The banks have to do all local lending. They take on all the risks and they can't diversify those risks out. Well, one of the beneficial innovations was this ability to diversify these risks out, to sell some of these loans off to a broader, well-diversified pool of loans across the United States. This is sometimes called securitization. And so that has a big positive associated with it. But a negative associated with it that we didn't fully understand is it suddenly made everyone interconnected to some of the same risks. Mm-hmm. And so the people who were thinking that, oh, well, you know, I've now got this well-diversified portfolio of mortgages across the U.S., I don't have to worry, didn't realize that they were now these mortgages were now part of a national pool. The data that had suggested that, well, if you diversify across the U.S., you're not going to see a downturn in all housing prices in the U.S. We haven't seen that since the 1930s. You had this false sense of confidence that came in, and the innovation, which had many positive aspects to it, changed the way the benefits of diversification worked, and so actually made many, many people subject to the same risk factor. And so suddenly there's a shock there, and then that spreads throughout the system much more quickly. So in the old days, we had just local shocks that would be devastating to banks, and that was not a very good system. Today, we have a system where the shocks could propagate out and spread more broadly, and hopefully with some of the regulatory reforms, like what Schiller and I talked about, we can make it less likely that we'll see the same kinds of ramifications that we had most recently. That's one of the things that Bob and I talk about in that
right.
book.
No, and I wanted to set up that nutshell point, and I think it's one that really does an excellent job of giving us the main concepts and also giving us a way to think about them. And it takes a point of view that, you know, these things were done not to rook somebody, but they were entering new territory. Sometimes with a good intention, but there was not perhaps the foresight and also the things that you can never see. That's called the future.
Yeah, disruptive change. I mean, we talk about it all the time with respect to the internet, but it can happen even with something as traditional as home mortgages, just these new types of securities, which, as I said, have many beneficial aspects, but have some hidden dark sides to them also.
So looking back now after your service there, 3 years on the Fed during all of this, the many, many reforms, debates, testimony that came back, then returning to academia, breathing probably for a day or two, somewhere in there, I hope. You and Bob Schiller and others, of course, but you in this formal setting sort of do a dual looking back at what happened and looking at what might be happening. But tell us a bit about the general perspectives each of you come from or are seen as coming from that make this dialogue have a reason.
So Bob focuses a lot on humanizing and democratizing finance, and actually he's written a book subsequently expanding on the themes that were in this original back and forth that we had had. And so he's thinking about, well, what can people understand? What data are people familiar with and can deal with? And if we get too complex, maybe we should shy away from those kinds of securities, even if they can have some beneficial aspects like reducing the cost of home mortgages. The approach that I take is focused a bit more on the specifics of some of the regulatory challenges that we had, some of the lessons from the crisis, some of the things that we learned that were not nearly as robust to deal with these innovations that we thought because we didn't fully understand the innovations.
So give us an example from each of you.
So Bob's approach here is sort of very, very general about thinking about broadly about disclosure and understanding. Some of the specifics that I would have would be thinking about some reforms of the mortgage market, in mm-hmm. particular thinking about better disclosure related to home mortgages, both for the individuals taking them out and disclosure in the marketplace itself of understanding the details of the individual loans that go into these diversified securities that are then sold around the world.
So you're saying that there's still some areas where it's worth having some movement and some wiggle room and seeing how that works. And he's saying more, you know, we've been there and we don't want to do something that really doesn't directly benefit the mortgagees. Is that?
Well, Bob is very careful about being very prescriptive here. Because he, as he had said in the comments at the back of the book,
right.
his area of expertise is not the details of regulation. His is sort of a bigger picture idea about making sure that people have an understanding of things. And so I very much agree with that. And so in some sense, what I'm doing is doing a much more concrete translation of some of those things into, well, how would this work in different aspects of the financial markets?
Thank you.
How much of what you're working on now and what you and Schiller discuss and debate in really have an exchange on in this book, Reforming U.S. Financial Markets? We should say it's MIT Press, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT Press. How much of where you are now is what you might have thought is where you would be now had the last 10 years, 12 years not happened? What have you learned or changed about your views during the periods of economic crisis, government service, successful and less successful attempts to respond to that by government?
So I've learned that I know much less than I thought. And so many academics, not just at University of Chicago, but around the world, think they know how markets work, think they know how these securities work, know how to do do risk management. But I think we learned that it's much more challenging than our traditional models had said. The traditional models of macroeconomics had really thought of finance as sort of a sideshow, didn't really take into account these financial interconnections and how important they could be. There's really been a revolution in modern macroeconomics to try to integrate much more finance in, and many financial economists thinking about some of these bigger picture issues. So certainly one of the things that I learned was some humility. I really thought that I knew how markets operated, and in the crisis I could see how quickly markets could change. Deep liquid markets that could trade hundreds of millions of dollars and very, very smoothly could, within a month, turn into markets that were very, very fragile, very brittle, and that if you wanted to move $10 million, that would move the market, and you might not even be able to move that much. Mm-hmm. And when you can't be able to sell these securities, when you can't sell the securities in the market, you don't know what the value of the securities are. And so then when you're trying to assess whether a financial institution is bankrupt or not, whether its assets are greater than its liabilities, you need to have a pretty good idea of what the value of those underlying assets are. And in a very fragile and brittle market situation like this, you might not know. That generates a lot of uncertainty. And when people are very uncertain, they pull back.
Right. So you learn some additional humility, which is something, as you say, not always seen as the purview of academics, particularly not necessarily economists or finance people.
Hey,
it's said
not
it
just
seen. And what about, were there practicalities that changed for you, or were there areas that where you said, you know, I need to start devoting more attention to figuring out about X, and whereas that had not interested you, or something that you had been very involved in, and say, you know, they're going to pull back from that?
Well, I broadly had an interest in what economists had dismissively called kind of the plumbing of the system. And so I had actually done a little bit of work on that, but not a lot of work on it. But that was more than most economists had done. But it turns out that a lot of these somewhat boring, arcane things about just exactly how the pipes work, mm-hmm. and how things flow through the system are incredibly important. Now, obviously, if you've ever talked to a plumber, they know that.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The most important thing. If there's a leak in that pipe, that's a real problem.
Oh, yeah.
But economists had sort of didn't really focus on the specifics of the pipe. They just assumed that the liquidity would flow from one part to another because there were natural incentives to do that.
Right.
But it turns out that it can be much more difficult for that flow to occur because the pipe, which is the market, doesn't move, isn't quite as smooth, isn't quite as easy to work with as we thought. It can get clogged up quite easily because of people not knowing some information about how the markets work, or if the markets are not working well and you're not quite sure what the price of an underlying asset is, then people pull back and they say, I'm just not going to allow these flows to occur.
I think these are hugely important points for any person, and I think they're also very candid statements and very, very open, honest statements about that in everything that we do. We like to think we know a lot about it, particularly if you've done it for a long time. And it's very often the plumbing that we're not thinking about. I mean, I'm often asked questions about why in the side of me that is a music critic, I spend a lot of time talking with musicians. This is something many critics do not do, and or listeners, ticket buyers. And I have a simple response. Usually I say, do you play the trombone? And 99.9% of the people say, no, of course I don't play the trombone. I said, do you know much about playing the trombone? No. And, well, that's exactly the point. I'll never learn to play the trombone, but by knowing and talking exactly. to each someone from each section of the orchestra about how this actually work and what is it like to tour and what is it like to make a recording, I hope that then improves what I'm able to do when I'm talking about, quote unquote, the big picture. And
I think this is very important for policy, because I think many academics have very strong policy views, and I think that's extremely beneficial to get this into the mix to debate the ideas. But I think some of the certainties that I felt I had about certain approaches about approaches to policy are a little bit less certain, because I see that there are more more subtleties, and there are more things that I might not understand, and so I'm more willing to try to understand someone else's point of view mm-hmm. that might not convince me. Right. I may still have the views that I have, but things tend to be much more qualified. Whereas in academia, you typically don't get ahead by having a whole series of qualifications. You get ahead by having sort of the lightning insight right. that this is the way it works and this is the explanation. The world is a very complex place, and I'm sure that would be an explanation, but it's very hard in academia to just say, well, I've just contributed an explanation. You win prizes by having the explanation, not an explanation. But you make good policy by having an explanation rather than the explanation.
I'm reminded when I was entering the college at the University of Chicago, which is a long time ago now. It's about 36 or so years ago. They have an annual lecture called the Aims of Education Address, which is to all the incoming students. And in those days, the class was small enough we could all still fit into a large building. But Rockefeller Chapel, now it's a much larger group. And the individual who was giving the talk laid out some basic things that he thought we should keep in mind. And one of them was to have a sense of perspective and other things along those lines. And we all just came out and thought, oh, geez, what a bummer. And this is not why we – and, of course, it's the classic of Mark Twain. You know, if the mature and experienced try to teach the youth about what they know from being mature and experienced, they're just going to seem dumb. Right. And when you then have the experience and some additional age, you very often – see these things. It's a part of the human condition. But it's nice to know that an economist is human. I mean, one of the human sides, and I want to emphasize here, this is just, we're putting our toes in the water. I really think it's very important that in thinking about culture, in thinking about thinking, we don't limit ourselves to music or theater or any other thing. And I think that we need to have some venues where there can be some serious discussion, not just a soundbite or 5 minutes, about important topics. And I hope that we can continue this conversation with Randy and then maybe break down some of these areas and talk at greater length about some specific points. But I think it's been important to start to kind of give some sense of how an economist thinks and how an economist who has a foot in academia and a foot in government and himself in the real world puts these things together. So let us know what you think about that and how you've liked this particular program.
Mr. Shylock was stingy. I was miserly too. I was more selfish and crabby than a shellfish. Oh dear, it's queer what love can do. I'd give all my possessions for you. $5. I'm in good condition, and I've got ambition that belongs to you. 6 shirts and collars, debts beyond endurance on my life insurance that belongs to you. I've got a heart that must be spurting. Just be certain I'll be true. Take my $5, take my shirts and collars, take my heart that hollers. Everything I've got belongs to you. I've got $5, 85 relations, two lace combinations, they belong to you. Two coats with collars, Ma and Grandma wore 'em. All the moths adore 'em, they belong to you. I've got two lips that care for mating, therefore waiting will not do. Take my $5, take my coats and collars, take my heart that hollers. Everything I've got belongs to you.
One of the ways that you go through your life, and again, you talked about being an economist, goes back to the high school library, which is great. You also have had a lifetime connection with music. Tell us a bit about that.
So I took violin lessons when I was very young, and then took piano lessons for a number of years. For graduate, what I realized is I was much better at listening than playing.
So you already had that humility lesson. Right?
Well, certainly. Right. The headaches that were created for myself and my kind parents who had listened made it very clear that one needed to move to the other side. But having had that that experience of actually playing an instrument is very, very helpful in understanding and appreciating music. And I've always been very interested in both popular music and classical music. And
that's fine. What you're starting there, giving that basic background and jumping ahead, and then we're going to jump back to wrap this program up. But one of the great advantages for you of working in Washington was we have all this wonderful culture in our nation's capital. Deborah Rutter is not moving to Washington for nothing to run the Kennedy Center. It will be a unique additional set of challenges there. But we do have all these opportunities there and public and less known concert series and so on. And many of the people who officially are invited to them or run them either can't go or don't go. So you probably had all kinds of great opportunities to hear concerts at the World Bank or to sit in the presidential box at the Kennedy Center or something when you really wanted to hear the concert.
Yeah, I was very fortunate when I was working in the White House. If none of the there were tickets available, if the president wasn't going, if the cabinet secretaries weren't going, the tickets would be available. Although we tended to have very late nights, and usually the decision would be made 5 minutes before I can slip out for an hour or two to go see a concert, I'd be able to see things there, which was a great privilege. Also, being a big opera fan, I was able to once a year go to something the Washington National Opera puts on called the Opera Ball. And what was wonderful there is you would see people from all sides of the aisle together.
Right.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia are both very big opera fans.
Right.
Would
justices
see
of the U.S. Supreme Court and ideologically beyond opposites. Yeah.
Yes, they couldn't be more separate, but there's something that brings them together,
right,
which is opera.
Right.
And so it would be wonderful to see them at these events. Also, once I was very privileged to be able to go to the Supreme Court where Bryn Terfel was presenting a concert, and he really, really hammed it up. He was singing one of the arias from Don Giovanni as wooing either Donna Elvira, I think it was Donna Elvira,
yeah,
or Donna Anna, and he got down on his knees in front of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. and Justice Ginsburg is very traditionally attired. She tends to wear very long, either white or black gloves.
Right.
And so she really did seem something a bit out of the the past. And Bryn Terfel was really
Spain.
Marvelous in getting down on his knee and trying to woo her.
Yeah. When you were studying for and about to have your doctoral examination on your PhD thesis, you felt that music might be some help during a period of what must have been a very nervous and anybody's fragile in that kind of a situation. What did you do?
So I would often listen to music, sometimes as background, but sometimes just focusing on it to kind of clear my mind. But most distinctly, I remember just before going to my PhD thesis defense, I listened to two pieces of music. One was Don Giovanni's Descent to Hell, where the commendatore is saying, rispondimi, sort of answer me, repent. And he wouldn't. He stayed true to himself.
No.
And the other was someone else who stayed very much true to himself. This was Sid Vicious singing My Way.
Yes.
Which is a spectacular
the
rendition.
The ultimate remake of the what became the Sinatra song, the Paul Anka song that became the Sinatra song.
And what I liked about both of these is they
and
had—
here it is, the King of Punk,
completely different types of music.
Right.
But what they both said to me was something about sort of being independent and saying, trying to stay true to yourself. Mm-hmm. And sort of taking intellectual risks is something that I think one has to do to be a successful academic. And my thesis was an unusual thesis. And I was going in to defend this. And I sort of wanted inspiration both from Sid Vicious and Don Giovanni.
Was one of the people on that committee named Ben Bernanke?
Ben was not on my committee.
But
Robert Barrow was the thesis committee chair.
Okay. Well, a person who thinks for himself but very much enjoys explaining the thinking that he's been doing and why he's arrived at conclusions or perhaps more recently tentative conclusions or conclusions moving in a particular direction, but always things that cause us then as readers or listeners to think ourselves about these questions. And I think an area where reforming U.S. financial markets makes very clear that Randy Krosner and Bob Shiller, Robert J. Shiller, are in absolute agreement, which is that the economy and the government belong to the people and that we need to know more about these things so that we can contribute to decisions that are made and so they become decisions that are not only about us but with us. Is that a fair—
I think it's very important to have transparency, and during the time that I was there and subsequently while Ben was still chair, a lot of progress had been made in having more transparency, longer statements. Ben Bernanke was up on Capitol Hill constantly. He was more popular than Lady Gaga or Justin Bieber, just constantly being called up there. He did town hall meetings. He did 60 Minutes. These were things that were very different for the Fed, which had been much more reluctant to try to engage. Communication is one of the biggest challenges that something like the Federal Reserve has, and there's been a movement to try to talk more and try to be clear. That doesn't always work, but I think it moves in the right direction. But it's an enormous challenge. And a lot of the meetings that we had would be discussing not only the policy, what should interest rates be, should we buy this asset or that asset, but also how should we talk about this, how should we convey this?
There's a debate, and we'll have to read it on another program, but you can find it if you take a look on the internet for the transcripts of the that were released not too long ago of these Fed deliberations, but where just two words get a discussion. What exactly do we mean here by markets, and what do we mean by closely, and even how many syllables these words might contain. But it's both very funny, but it's also very important because it's a reminder, as every news event reminds us these days almost daily, that with all the communication, with the risk spreading that we have now, words get pounced on, and it's very important to attempt to be clear about what you're saying. Randy Krosner, I hope, as I say, that this will be the first of a number of conversations we can have. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about what an economist does, what you've done, and what he listens to in times of peril.
Porto di viltà, tacciato mai sarò. Rispondi, o già rispondo, ferrai.
Dita di no, dita di no!
O far, o far, e te.
Cos'è?
Che cielo
questo mai?
Che di faccia mia, e lui...
music we heard tonight. We opened with a song from the film version of the Broadway musical Cabaret. It replaced another Money song from that original Broadway show. This was Money, 1972, Liza Minnelli and Joel Grey together, Candor and Ebb, the creator of all the songs in that show, this one added for the film. As we carried on our conversation with Randy Krosner, we broke for Alfred Brendel, quite young, in the early 1960s, playing the Opus 129 of Beethoven, the rondo that has come to be known as Rage Over a Lost Penny. And then, how about Ella, Rodgers and Hart, 1931, from a show that I bet nobody remembers, America's Sweetheart. Ella's 1956 Rodgers and Hart songbook recording, I've Got $5. And as you heard, we asked Randy what music he listened to when he was preparing to complete his PhD, launching him on to quite a career in academia and government service. The Descent of Don Giovanni into Hell, which starts when a certain statue shows up to remind the Don that he has been invited for dinner. Gottlob Frege was the statue. Eberhard Vector was the Don. Giuseppe Taddei was also heard as Leporello in that 1961, I think the first recording of Don Giovanni Mozart made by Carlo Maria Giulini, certainly not the last. The Philharmonia Orchestra and Chorus recorded back in the Abbey Road studios. And then I'm fairly confident that we can say that not the first time the song has ever been played on WFMT, but very possibly the first time Sid Vicious's version from 1978, just a few months before he died of a drug overdose in 1979 at the age of, 22 or so. Sid Vicious's My Way. Paul Anka said that he had been kind of discombobulated by that version. He, of course, created a version out of the French song, but created new lyrics when he made the song that Sinatra made famous. But then he said the guy seemed really sincere, and he accepted that version. Tell us what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line. Rentap, it's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, or visit us anytime online, WFMT.com/critical thinking, where you can experience the always free Critical Thinking podcast. WFMT has a Facebook page, too. You may visit us and comment to us there. We'd like to thank Randy for making the trip and patiently waiting for this program to air 4 months after we recorded it. We'd like to thank Matt DiStefano for recording it, putting the program together with me, and making it sound great. Alphawood Foundation is our major funder. We thank them and all other funders and friends of this program. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.